You're listening to the Business for Good podcast, the show where you'll hear inspirational stories about companies making money by solving some of the world's most pressing problems. I'm your host, Paul Shapiro, and I'm glad you've joined us. Hello, friend, and welcome to episode number 139 of the Business for Good podcast. This episode is the seventh in our multi-part podcast series on cultivated meat. The previous six episodes include the CEOs of Eat Just, Fork and Good, Mosa Meat, New Harvest, Aleph Farms, and Blue Nalu. We have been getting very good feedback from listeners on this series, so it should please you to know that we still have three more episodes in this particular cultivated meat series to go after this one, forming maybe not the Ten Commandments, but perhaps more like the Ten Commanding Cultivated Meat episodes one must consume if they want an understanding of the current state of play in this sector. And of course, if you want to understand the history of cellular agriculture and where it's been and where it may now be going, there is a new, updated paperback edition of my book, Clean Meat, that is now out, and you can get it wherever books are sold. So make sure you treat yourself and order your copy of Clean Meat now. Now, speaking of now, this episode is one that will surely intrigue you. That's because it's not really a secret that Asia is leading the world when it comes to semiconductors, solar panels, wind turbines, and other technologies that will frankly be critical for the future. In a time when several U.S. states are seeking to ban the sale of cultivated meat, Asia seems to be leaning into the technology, and one of the most mature companies in the space there is Avant Meats. Founded in Hong Kong in 2018 and having raised about $15 million to date, Avant Meats is focused on making a dent in Asian seafood demand. In this episode, Avant founder and CEO Carrie Chan discusses why her focus is seafood, what scale she's at and where she hopes to soon go, and how long she thinks it will be before cultivated fish might reach 1% market share in Asia. As you'll hear in this conversation, Avant Meats is already animal component free in its feedstock for its fish sales, and it's cultivating inside a 250-liter bioreactor to generate the material for its public tastings. Now headquartered in Singapore, the company intends to grow there and eventually branch out throughout Asia, a project for which it is currently fundraising. I now bring you Avant Meats CEO, Carrie Chan.
Carrie, welcome to the Business for Good podcast.
Thank you, Paul, for having me today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. We've gotten to be speakers on panels together before, but we've never really gotten a chance to have a one-on-one conversation. So I'm very excited to be talking with you all the way from Singapore. I think that you started the company in Hong Kong, but then moved to Singapore. That's right, correct?
Correct. We expanded to Singapore in 2021.
Okay. And what led you to go from Hong Kong to Singapore? Was it the Eat Just regulatory approval that happened in Singapore, or was there some other reason you wanted to go there?
The strategy was plotted back in 2020 before we knew that the approval, December the 2nd, I remember woke up to read the news on the 2nd of December 2020. But before that, we are already plotting the plan to expand to Singapore. Reason being that Hong Kong is a very good starting point for biotech startup, but then there is not ecosystem for bioprocess industry. For example, there's no talent in the bioprocess industry because there is no pharmaceutical or drug manufacturing within Hong Kong. So we find that there's a challenges of recruiting talent as well as having the ecosystem of suppliers. So we basically need to go to other places. And Singapore is a very obvious destination within Asia at that time.
Nice. Okay. Cool. Well, I hope to be over there. I shamefully have never been to Hong Kong or Singapore. I guess I've been in the Hong Kong airport, but I've never left the airport, and I've never even been in an airport in Singapore. So I would love to correct that. But for now, let me ask you this just to get started. I mean, you know very well that in countries like the United States, there's a lot of malaise seemingly around cultivated meat. Many news headlines seem to paint a grim picture. Journalists are writing the obituaries for this industry before it's even gotten out of the cradle, so to speak. Is that the same in Asia? Is there a similar sentiment that has taken hold there? Or is it not true that in Singapore, people are feeling this way?
Yeah, in Singapore, I think in particular, I think generally the general impression or the trend, the sentiment are still very supportive for alternative protein and cultivated meat. But what you mentioned, that trend, I do see that creeping up in different parts of the world, like including Europe as well. So hopefully it will not be getting into too much of a momentum here in Asia. I think the concerned stakeholder or political related kind of like side of thing is a little bit different here. So hopefully that will not be developed in that magnitude. Yeah.
Is most of the funding for Avant Meats coming from Western venture capital funds, or is it coming from Asian funds as well, or solely?
Yeah, so our investor cap table basically quite balanced internationally. So we do have a major lead investor, 2G from US for our Series A. The remaining part of the cap table is all spread out across different parts of the world. So yeah, and at the moment we see that is not a major, that the topic that you raised now has not been a factor in our conversation with potential investors.
Great. Yeah, I know you've raised a good amount of money so far. I think you initially raised $3 million, and then in 2022, you raised another $11 million. And you're focused really on seafood, right? So, you know, you've got other companies that are working on fish, or excuse me, on chicken or on beef, and you all, like the folks at Blue Nalu, who we recently had on this podcast as well, are focused really on fish. And for listeners who aren't familiar with Asian seafood consumption, it is really remarkable. You know, China alone produces more than a third of all of the world's seafood, and it consumes nearly half of the world's seafood. And so in China, they consume 65 million tons of seafood annually, whereas in the US, it's about 7 million tons annually. So just for perspective, you can see the dramatic popularity of seafood in places like China and in other Asian countries compared to the United States and other Western countries. So what type of fish or other aquatic animal meats are you all making? And then let's talk about the scale at which you are making it, Carrie.
Yeah, sure. So we have several already developed immortalized cell line. As we know, we need to start with cell line. And we have grouper, we have eel, we have snapper, we have minnow. And so there are different stages of the development. We also actually have another marine creature that we actually have experienced developing cell line, but that we work on a relatively stealth mode. So we look forward to actually elaborate that once it is ready. So basically at the moment, we're focusing on the fish species that I've just mentioned. Our Singapore plant has already scaled up to pilot production. So we are running a couple of 100 liters of bioreactor in single-use bioreactor at the moment to start producing some material so that we can continue to do a lot of product development on the different food formulation, et cetera.
So you have a couple 100-liter reactors that are single-use. How much does that enable you to produce? I know you've done public tastings of these products, so you're producing enough for tastings, but obviously you're not going to be able to produce commercially out of a pilot plant. But what can you produce?
Yeah, so we have a 50-liter, and then we have a 250-liter. And they allow us to produce kind of multiple, let's say, tens of kilograms of cell mass. And then depending on the product formulation, the percentage of cell in the end product, that will translate into the respective amount of the product we can produce with that, which is pretty reasonable, sizable, that we can throw a tasting event, as you mentioned. We held an event, closed door event, end of last year, hosting about 30 people. That output is easily can be done in that context. Yeah.
Is it easy to grow fish cells compared to chicken or beef cells? I'll give you an example. Lou Cooperhouse, the CEO of Blue Nalu, has made the point to me before that the bioreactors can be kept at a lower temperature because fish are cold-blooded animals, whereas obviously chickens and cows are warm-blooded animals. And so it's less energy intensive, apparently, to grow fish cells than to grow chicken or cow cells. Is that your experience?
Yeah, indeed, the temperature that we need to keep for the cell culture is lower than mammalian cells. So in generally, that is pretty true. So we also do not need to keep our cell, for example, to 37 or even beyond that. For what I understand, some of the cell actually require that level or even higher level of temperature.
That's really interesting. So, okay, If that is so, do you think that there are other advantages aside from temperature? From what I've heard, it's actually easier, just if, independent of temperature, but just easier to tame these fish cells. Is that accurate, or have I been misinformed on this?
Well, I think it is difficult to put fingers on it, but based on the trend and the pattern that what we have. Because obviously a lot of the company like ourselves, we only work on one animal species, like be it fish, chicken or pork or beef. But then we don't, very few of us actually work across different kind of species. So we cannot do a very direct comparison, but we can only gauge what we understand from what we read in the public domain. Indeed, I think it's also depending on the cell line. The different route of setting up the cell line would also mean that the nutrient requirement of the cell line to maintain the status of the proliferation or the production will be a bit different. But in that sense, I think we use a pretty direct approach to come up with a cell line, which is a spontaneous immortalization. And with that, I think that gives us a relatively simpler kind of like growth condition required for the fish cells to grow. So that is, can't these two factors are related species as well as a cell line situation, as well as the medium that the nutrient required to sustain the process.
Great. Okay. Very cool. Very cool. So Carrie, you mentioned that you're operating a 250 liter bioreactor and a 50 liter reactor, and that you're able to produce tens of kilos of animal cell mass at a time, which you would add presumably to plant-based material to maybe double or so the amount of product, of finished good that you can make. Just to be clear, I believe that you all advertise that you don't use animal ingredients in your media, right? You're not using any animal inputs at all in this process.
Correct. What we're running the pilot run now is actually animal component free. So what we find that after we remove the fetal bovine serum, indeed, some of the ingredient is still sourced from animal source. And so we did actually done further R&D to replace those with animal component free. So it's a bit more stringent requirement, actually. So our medium now for pilot is actually ACF.
And so ACF meaning animal component free, does it work just as well? And is it as expensive or cheaper to go ACF?
It's definitely cheaper because FES is expensive and some of the animal based are generally more expensive. So ACF is generally more cost effective, as well as fulfilling the environmental kind of like requests.
And so the cells grow in the same way and they grow as fast as if you were using, you know, animal serum.
So it's very comparable, yeah.
Amazing. Now, I've often wondered, and maybe you know something about this, if all of these companies in the cultivated meat industry in the last few years claim that they've moved away from using fetal bovine serum, right? So in the pharma industry, it's been very typical to use FBS, which is why the companies in the space have been using it. But if they've really innovated ways to get around it, why would anybody use it? Like in the pharmaceutical industry, if you can grow with ACF and it's cheaper, why wouldn't everybody, even outside of cultivated meat, who might be an FBS customer, switch to that? Are you aware, are people in pharma switching now that these new innovations in animal component-free media have been innovated?
Yeah, you're right. Actually, ACF is not a new concept for cultivated meat. It actually exists in the pharmaceutical sector as well, because I think the FBS has a problem with the potential risk, for example, the mad cow disease back a couple of decades. Quality control and variation from one batch to the other is also one of the challenge for pharmaceutical production. So to my understanding, a certain percentage at least of the pharmaceutical process, wherever they will be suitable to do that, they use ACF approach to coming up with the culture medium. Yeah.
Well, that is really interesting. I wonder, like, you know, how has the industry that sells FBS, have they suffered as a result of this? You know, like, is this kind of like, you know, the first animal-based industry to actually be negatively impacted by the cultivated meat industry? That would be quite interesting if that turned out to be true.
Yeah, I hope so. Although there are quite a lot of R&D will still relying on FBS, because FBS is the always go to at the get-go where any cell line that people will start, they will start with FBS, be it 20% or 10%. Is basically want to make sure that the process can be established in the cell primary culture, and then they try to phase it out. But then it will still be quite popular among R&D. But I agree with you. I totally support that if down the line, the ACF approach could be more prevalent, not just in cultivated meat sector, but other sector, that will be very much like ideal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if there's somebody listening to this podcast and you know that the people who make FBS have been negatively impacted by the cultivated meat folks, I would be thrilled to hear about it. Just send me a message via the website, businessforgoodpodcast.com. I would love to hear from you about that. Okay, let's go now to Singapore. I believe that you have filed already for regulatory approval in Singapore. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we have submitted and working with the SFA, but it's going to be a few quarters, kind of several months of processes. So finger crossed, we're expecting going through the process this year.
Great. Have you filed for regulatory approval in other jurisdictions aside from Singapore?
At the moment, we're focusing on Singapore, but we have been basically keeping track very closely, of course, with the US. Israel is a new development, but of course, it may not be a market that we will particularly focusing on in the near term. But we have actually follow quite a lot about development within the other countries in Asia. So to mention a little bit, we are part of the PAC Society for Cellular Agriculture. It is a group of company in this space only working on cultivated meat in Asia from Hong Kong, China, Singapore, Korea, Japan, etc. We join together actually do a lot of work related to regulatory pathway as well as public domain and consumer education. So through those platform, through that platform and our activity, we kind of take into a lot of development what is happening in different countries and government agencies. Yeah, in this
nice.
Region.
Nice. And it's interesting you mentioned Israel because we recently had on Didier Tubia, the CEO of Aleph Farms. And even though their company is based in Israel, they're looking to open their first pilot plant in Southeast Asia, in Thailand.
Right.
So, you know, while Israel is like the mecca for cultivated meat companies, it seems, in terms of founding them, it's such a tiny market. There's so few people who live there that it seems like they all want to go start selling in places like the US or Singapore, Southeast Asia, China, and so on. So it's really, really something. Obviously, Israel has been a very friendly market for cultivated meat and alternative protein in general. Singapore is the same. The same is so for the US, where you have a huge number of the cultivated meat companies based. What about China? I know that Avant was started in Hong Kong, but we have this sense in the United States that China has taken the lead on so many technologies, right? Or at least Asia has. If you look at semiconductors, right? We are importing nearly all of our semiconductors from Taiwan. If you look at solar panels, wind turbines being produced in Asia. In fact, the solar panels on my own roof were produced in China. And so there's a sense that we in the US don't want to fall behind when it comes to clean proteins, right? We've already fallen behind on semiconductors and clean energy. Are we going to fall behind? What do you think? Is China and Asia positioning itself to be the leaders in cultivated meat? Is the government there friendlier? As you know, we have legislation in the US right now seeking to restrict cultivated meat, not to support it. But when we hear about China, we hear that the opposite is so, that part of China's plan is to actually be a leader in this. So as somebody who actually lives in the region, what do you think? Is China and Asia going to be positioning itself to be a leader in cultivated meat?
Right. That's a very good question. So on two levels, on the regulatory level, which is more drilling into the technicality of giving approval for any company to start selling to the public, right? I think that the US FDA framework, as well as the Singapore SFA framework, is generally a bit more open, as well as a little bit more approachable. Indeed, there are quite a lot of development in China related to the regulatory development. So we have been in multiple conversations with the relevant agency. And so the framework is under development. But it's good that it's under development, because obviously China started working on the regulatory development a few years later than the other countries such as Singapore and US. But indeed, they're working on it now. On the technicality level, what we get the sense at the moment is that the regulator in China has the potentially be a little bit more stringent in the process. So that means that the approval process would be a bit more elaborate or maybe a little bit longer. So that's on one part. But on the other side, whether the policy on the high level will be very like different, I think that is a totally different from the regulatory compliance aspect. It's more related to the policy, whether the country supports the development of the technology. On that aspect, I think indeed it does cultivated meat fall into the country direction to develop when it comes to increasing food security, for example. It was in the most recent 5-year plan, like the government announced that the area that the country will focus in the upcoming years. And I think that is the any bioeconomy, the biosynthetic, including cultivated meat, is under that bracket. So which is actually a good thing. At the moment, how much resources or support that will be actually funneled into development of this technology, we don't have the number as yet. But the positive side is that it is on the agenda, on the strategy. But I think that at least on my end, I see that there are some funding supporting the development of this technology, but it's not a massive scale at the moment. So it's still maybe a little bit too early to say. Yeah, that is what I know from our perspective.
Got it. Okay. Do you think that the environment in mainland China is ripe for cultivated meat startups to get started? I know you started in Hong Kong and eventually moved to Singapore, but what about mainland China?
Yeah, you asked a very good question here. I think for startup, where is the good place to start is down to whether the company has the ecosystem or support to actually start R&D as well as have a route to commercialization. Such that they can attract investors. So if we use that as a deduction, then that means that I think R&D, of course, mainland China is a lot of research institute. They are highly capable of doing R&D. But when it comes to the regulation and the route to commercialization cultivated in China, it will still be a few years time and the path is not very clear at the moment. So that means that it will be pretty much challenging at this point of time as of today to find investor if it is purely based in the China market. So this is what I would say. But this kind of thing can change pretty quickly in the next 1 to 2 years when the regulatory kind of pathway become a little bit more visible. It may come back because obviously the market is big and there are certain high level policy support at like what I've just mentioned. But in the near term, I think it will still be challenging because any startup like in our position, it is quite capital intensive, right? So we do need to find investor and the investor will definitely ask, how is the commercialization timeline and route for the jurisdiction that the company is based in? So because of that, I think it will be still need to have a very much like a creative strategy if the company want to start in China, but want to also cater to get the like capital market funding.
Great. So let's talk about what you just mentioned, the timeline for commercialization. You're running at largest right now a 250-liter reactor. You've stated publicly that your goal is to fundraise and move to, I think, a 2,000-liter reactor, right? So how much will a 2,000-liter reactor allow you to produce? And when do you think you could be producing? If today somebody listening to this podcast funded your entire next round, they said, okay, you know, Carrie, we're going to give you everything you need for your next round. How soon would it be before you could be not only building a 2,000-liter system, but actually selling from it, presuming you had regulatory authority? And how much would you be selling?
Yeah, so the 2,000-liter bioreactor will basically, the projection of the will be actually linear extension from what we can do now at the smaller size before any further improvement of our optimization of the process. And the timeline, because of we're doing the design now, actually, and then the implementation will take place sometime in 2025. So we're looking at towards end of 2025, then we can actually start larger scale of commercialization at that point. But if we get actually our SFA approval before that, we might be doing smaller scale kind of commercialization in Singapore.
Do you think that 2,000 liters is what you would consider commercial scale, or is that more like a larger pilot plant?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think I have heard different kind of approaches in this industry. I've heard actually plan to go up to 10,000 liter bioreactor, etc. I think it will be very down to different markets. So for example, in Singapore, where I come from a property development and real estate, so I'm very sensitive to that. Because a lot of the location or the factory that we can build our facility is not greenfield project. So it's not on the ground. So that means that we need to set ourselves up inside a factory building. So that means that there are certain restrictions in terms of the height, the loading, and the size of the bioreactor we can keep. And so I think that is one of the driving force in terms of the larger size that what we can put. Of course, it is in a market whereby there are quite a bit of abundance of open space. Of course, the size of the commercial bioreactor should be larger. That's one consideration. The other consideration is that we're also looking at the flexibility of different batches, as well as the risk of contamination. For example, if I have a very big batch, like 10,000 liter bioreactor, and any issue with any batch, I think it will be quite a bit of a very sizable kind of like risk as well. So that means that in addition to scaling up, there are also the option of scaling out, which is actually doing multiple medium size, large size of bioreactor versus doing one super large size of bioreactor. I think that will be very much down to different companies and different market situation to make the best sense of that.
Right. Yeah. On past episodes recently on this podcast, we've had very varied opinions about this. So Nia Gupta from Fork and Good said that she could envision a craft brewery, so to speak, that has a ton, you know, several 1,000 liter reactors, whereas somebody like Josh Tetrick from Good Meat wants to build, you know, a 250,000 liter reactor, right? Like something that's just absolutely gigantic and much, much bigger than what has been envisioned by some others here. And they're definitely different cost structures and risks and benefits associated with that. And it's hard to tell what may end up happening. But how long do you think it'll take to get to those scales? So you're saying that the produce is linear. So if in a 250 liter reactor, you're producing tens of kilos, I presume that's per run, and each run might take a couple weeks. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yep.
And so let's just say generously, you can do 20 runs a year, and you're, you know, let's just say you're going to produce 50 kilos. So, you know, you're producing thousands of kilos or tens of thousands of kilos if you were to, you know, continuously operate in a 250. So how many can you produce in 2000? Well, let's just say then you might be able to produce even a million tons. A million kilos. Let's just say that's it. It's not going to be that much, but just for the sake of, you know, let's say you're wildly successful and it's more productive than you would have imagined. As we were pointing out, Asia consumes alone 65 million tons of seafood. So how long do you think it'll be before even 1% of China's fish consumption is coming from cultivated meat? Do you think that's happening 5, 10, 15, 25 years away? Like, what do you think it'll take to get to 1% of 65 million tons?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I think there are two factors at play here. One is, of course, the production capacity, which we have. I think it is actually the most recent industry discussion about the CapEx investment in all of these plants and the lead time to build all of this. I think that is one aspect of the factor affecting that on its alone may take some time. And then the other is the market consumer getting familiar with this new tech food, and which I think actually, that part will be maybe taking, well, with a bit of luck. I think if there is something like what we see in the oatmeal, like dairy alternative, maybe that will all of a sudden kind of shoot up, all of a sudden with a lot of product kind of happening in the market. But generally,
But even with demand, even if the demand is there, I mean, 1% of 65 million tons, if my math is correct, it's still 650 million pounds, you know, like 650 million kilos, actually. So, you know, that is it's so hard to imagine how we're going to get there. I mean, maybe I'm not thinking about it properly. What do you think? Like, you know, the quantity of bioreactor space that would be needed to get there, it seems so vast.
Yeah, okay. So to get back to the question more specifically, a bit more on the high level, I agree with you. Let's say the consumption are there. How quickly can we get to that point? I think if you ask me on the optimistic side, I think we might be able to reach that in 10, 15 years. We don't need to build out a big plant in multiple places. It can be actually a very decentralized approach where different city, different towns that they have individual kind of local operator can be licensed to have a set of this, right? And then they can actually already produce for the neighborhood, for the region that they cater for. And I think that can happen simultaneously in multiple places throughout the world, throughout Asia at the same time. If you look at the real estate, the amount of, I think people ask about, okay, the number of the stainless steel and the amount of the material to build into this plant that is massive. If you look into any compared to other township development infrastructure, if you look at Shenzhen, I think Shenzhen was developed in the past maybe 20, 30 years from a very much like quiet fishing village to now a metropolis. And how much resources and what is the scale of development in that? You can see a lot of the things is actually possible. Yeah, with the right factors in place.
Okay. I'll make sure to link to that transformation there for sure at businessforgoodpodcast.com. I do want to ask you, Carrie, if the problem for you right now is capital or is it still technological development that needs to occur? If you had, you know, somebody who came in and gave you $100 million, would you have solved the technological challenges that you need to solve in order to commercially produce at an economical scale? Or would you still have more R&D that needs to be done first before you can actually get to that place where you're selling millions of kilos a year?
Yeah, I would say that 95% of the technical already clear, so we can actually produce in a very steady output level. But I would say that at the moment, the output percentage or the cell mass is not optimized. It's just like when I have not been maxed out on my production capacity. Let's say my 2000 liter bioreactor, I can produce that much of today. Of course, I want to produce more by optimizing my process or making, for example, the cell density higher, for example, and using less medium, for example. So that is what we are actually working on now. But at the base where we start, we can start producing. We have everything already on board.
That's great. Okay. Well, I hope that you do find that investor, Carrie, who's going to let you start at least building the plane before you start flying. And so you can get a head start there. Let me ask you if there are any resources that have been helpful for you. You've been running this company now for 6 years. Surely you've learned a lot about startups and cultivated meat in the 6 years that you've been running it. Are there any resources that have been helpful for you in your journey as an entrepreneur that you would recommend to others who want to follow in your footsteps or do something good for the world themselves?
Yeah, I actually think that it is a very, very, very amazing kind of ecosystem. This first day I actually started the company, unlike in other kind of tech trend, for example, fintech or whatever, where the startup founders would need to map out quite a lot of things themselves. But here, I think there's a lot of kind of like very nice people and mission aligned people like yourself, Paul, as well as like GFI, as well as some of these NGO. They actually done a lot of groundwork for us before we even started the company. Like have a summary about what is the technology landscape out there and what are the challenges. And actually, it was very helpful when I started to position what we work on in terms of the project as well as the product and the strategy as well. And along the way, a lot of conversation like this also helped with promoting and getting more people know about this technology. I think I am very grateful for this. I do not see this, to be honest, in some other tech space, like let's say fintech, what I just mentioned. So I think this is very unique for this industry because I think at least a major bulk of us actually sustainably driven and very mission aligned, which is very appreciative of.
Got it. Okay. And are there any companies that you wish exist that don't yet exist? Anything that you hope that somebody who wants to make a difference, maybe they want to start a company like you did, and they don't know what to do. What do you think the world needs?
Yeah, I think where that is partly covered here is that the CapEx, I think quite a number of us, including some of our investors, always wondering where are the CDMO for cultivated meat? Where are the CDMO company for cultivated meat? Are they there already? Where do we find them? The answer is that I think they are not there yet. There are company doing pharmaceutical CDMO would want to branch off to cultivated meat, but in terms of the cost structure, price structure is still not worked out yet. So I hope that someone who will, that is what we need actually in the next phase to actually accelerate quite a bit of this production capacity increase.
So kind of like what Liberation Labs is seeking to do for precision fermentation, you know, in Indiana in the United States, they're building a precision fermentation CDMO. Like they only want to build the hardware so that other people can come and put their organisms in there. So it's a big bet. We'll see if it pays off for them. But I saw they just put up their first bioreactor, which looked pretty cool. It's very tall and thin. They're posting photos on LinkedIn of it. I'll include those in the show notes for this episode at businessforgoodpodcast.com. But for now, Carrie, I want to say thank you. I really appreciate all that you are doing to advance the cultivated meat space. It's a real pleasure to get to talk with you, and I'll be rooting for you as you continue to fundraise and get to that next 2,000 liter stage for the company.
Thank you so much, Paul.
And I want to say before we go, I really appreciate that in your background, listeners will not be able to see this since we don't actually publish the video of these interviews. But in Carrie's background, she has a Vitamix. That's the one thing that you can see, which is, I've often said, if there's a fire in my house, the one object I'm saving
is to make sure that you catch is a Vitamix. Yes.
Yeah, it's an expensive blender. Okay. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thank you. Paul, have a nice evening.
Thanks for listening. I hope you found it useful. And if you did, please let the world know. Leave the show a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast app and share the episode with your friends. Who knows? Maybe you'll inspire one of them to be in the business of doing good themselves.